Hello, Marginalia Radio listeners. This is Art Remillard with a quick message before we begin the show. The host for today's episode is my friend, David Krueger. Dave is a scholar, author, and educator based in Philadelphia. He specializes in American religious history with a tilt toward the ways that popular religious culture flourishes outside the bounds of institutional and denominational religion. You might know Dave from his recent article at Marginalia entitled Straight Edge Religion, Hardcore Punk and the Sober Revolution. If you haven't read it yet, check it out. Also, he has a terrific book coming out with the University of Minnesota Press called Myths of the Runestone, Viking Martyrs and the Birthplace of America. I'll be interviewing Dave when it comes out in October. Meanwhile, David will be helping me with first impressions, doing more author interviews on new and forthcoming books in religion, history, and theology. For the past few months, Dave has been helping me with the behind-the-scenes work that go into producing these episodes, to include selecting the books, writing scripts, and recording and editing. Now that he has a handle on all of this, you'll be hearing a lot more from Dave. And I think that you will find, just as I have, that Dave is both a terrific scholar and a great guy to know. So without any further delay, I'll turn it over to David Krueger. Thank you for listening, and enjoy the show.
Greetings and welcome to First Impressions, a production of Marginalia Radio. I'm your host, Dave Krueger. Joining us is Mark T. Mulder, Associate Professor of Sociology at Calvin College in Grand Rapids, Michigan. Mark is the author of the new book, Shades of White Flight, Evangelical Congregations and Urban Departure, published by Rutgers University Press in 2015. Mark, welcome to Marginalia Radio.
Thank you very much, Dave. It's good to be here.
What have scholars typically understood to be the factors that contributed to white flight, and what have they missed? So in other words, why did you write this book?
David, I wrote this book because too often white flight is seen as this monolithic movement of whites out of the city. There's a growing literature that tries to problematize that and say maybe the term white flight is misleading and covers up a lot of the complexity. I would argue the term makes it sound like a very simplistic process where the whites all left in terror as soon as an African-American showed up on their block. Folks have often thought, well, the decline of Detroit began with the riots in late 1960. Well, no, the origins of the urban crisis are roughly 20 years earlier with the Great Migration bringing African-Americans to Detroit and then how they became economic competitors for whites and housing competitors. And that's really the roots of the urban crisis in the United States. And my book is contributing to some of that literature that makes us rethink our assumptions about historical processes, but then also making a claim for religion matters perhaps in ways we don't fully understand. Right? That's why it's shades of white flight, that there's all kinds of different reasons why people left and when they left. Religion is a sometimes overlooked factor.
Could you tell us a little bit about the history of the Chicago neighborhoods that you discuss in your book to give us more of a sense of the texture of what white flight looked like?
The two neighborhoods that I focused on were Englewood and Roseland, both on the south side of the city, separated by about 5 miles. The term that we use for the expansion of African Americans on the south side of Chicago was the Black Belt. As the Black Belt moved literally block by block, as you know, unscrupulous real estate agents would prey on white families nervous about their, you know, their housing investments, say, look it, there's African Americans just a block over, you can sell now while you still can. And so they would leave in a panic. So the Black Belt starts hitting Englewood in the 1950s. Just to give you a sense of the radical demographic change that occurs in that decade, Englewood went from 10.5% African American to almost 70% in 10 years. And then similarly, so Roseland, it happens about a decade later. Roseland is near the Pullman factory, so it became a pretty heavy industrial area. Some of the public housing projects were located near Roseland, so that exacerbates tensions between African Americans and whites. And a lot of that change occurs between the 1970s and 1980s. The white population in Roseland actually drops by 96% in those 10 years from 1970 to 1980. So by 1980, Roseland is 97% African American. It was a fairly vibrant shopping district with a number of department stores that anchored the area. But by the 1980s, almost all of that was gone along with the whites, a lot of that economic vitality. The reasons why property values tended to drop in these neighborhoods wasn't the arrival of African Americans. It was because of the way that whites left so quickly.
Your study focuses on a collection of Christian Reformed churches. Could you tell our listeners a little bit about that tradition and how so many of them ended up on the south side of Chicago?
Many folks know that the Dutch have actually been in the United States, or what would become the United States, for a long time with the founding of New Amsterdam. And so that was considered the first immigration. But a second immigration occurs in the late 1830s and into the 1850s. Because of economic hardship, some changes in church life in the Netherlands, we have a second wave of Dutch immigrants who are actually helped by the older Dutch who have been in the country for a long time. The second immigration of Dutch folks tended to settle around the southern shore of Lake Michigan. So there's kind of a band that stretches from where I am in Grand Rapids, Michigan, and all the way through Chicago, and then up into Racine, Wisconsin, Sheboygan, Wisconsin, and then a few outlying areas out in Iowa and Minnesota as well. Those Dutch immigrants were initially part of the RCA. So the RCA is an older Dutch church that had been here for many years, and they helped with the immigration process of these new immigrants. These two groups felt like they had enough ecclesiastical fellowship so that they should join the RCA. And so it's only one denomination for a number of years. But then in 1857, a group of dissatisfied new immigrants secedes from the RCA and eventually becomes what is known today as the Christian Reformed Church in North America. Very much a Calvinist theological tradition. Looks like a Presbyterian church in terms of church polity. Still to this day, tends to have a high level of Dutch ethnicity. Very much is supportive of the idea of Christian schools. They are heavily influenced by the Dutch newspaper publisher and university founder and prime minister, Abraham Kuyper, who said that Christians should be engaged in all parts of culture, but part of that is training our young people in Christian schools. And so the CRC, almost all social life is bound up in these two institutions, the church and then Christian school. So to be a parent or family in good standing within a CRC, it was assumed that you would also send your child or children to the Christian school. The Dutch who arrived and chose the south side of Chicago, they tended to be produce farmers or would start market gardens. So these are fairly fertile areas that were somewhat close to the markets of Chicago.
Could you describe the process by which the churches and their members made the shift to the suburbs? What reason did they give for leaving?
The reasons were usually fairly heavily coded that their style of worship or their way of doing church just was not attractive to the folks who were moving into the neighborhood. So that was a reason to leave, that the church was eventually going to die because there are other CRC churches in the suburbs where folks would end up if we didn't move. And so there were some limited attempts at engaging the newly arriving African Americans, but in most times they wouldn't necessarily assume that any of the African Americans who were arriving would actually want to worship at a CRC church. And they weren't willing to necessarily change any of their culture or processes to become more hospitable. And so what a typical CRC strategy then is to establish a mission or a chapel for that kind of outreach. So that the idea is that you can reach the new demographic that's in the neighborhood without changing what we actually do at church. And you have a number of instances where the churches actually got together. We need to be in communication with each other about when or if we're going to leave so that we can have some kind of concerted effort, do this strategically. Well, what I found out was even that ad hoc committee failed to stop anyone from leaving or allow for open communication. Because one of the churches went ahead and made a purchase out in the suburbs without even telling the other three churches in Roseland.
You note that there are some important differences between the two Dutch Reformed denominations, the Christian Reformed Churches, CRC, and the Reformed Church of America, the RCA. How did these differences matter in how these churches related to their Chicago neighborhoods?
To an outsider, the CRC and the RCA look and function like the exact same church or denomination, same Dutch ethnicity, sing the same songs, same theological tenets, both use the same confession. And so in many ways, the differences are indistinguishable. But there are key differences that I tease out. And the first would be the idea of Christian education. For the CRC, that becomes a crucial component of their identity. This idea that we send our kids to Christian school and we believe that the Christian faith should be a component in all of life. And that we want to train our children to be citizens who take their faith very seriously. The RCA, on the other hand, does not have that same history. They're very strong proponents of the public school system and having their children within those systems being salt and light. In some ways, that's emblematic of the way that the RCA was a bit more engaging or open to broader culture. The CRC is much more closed, a bit more cloistered in how they interacted with broader culture. For instance, at one point, even for the CRC, if you married an RCA woman or man, some CRC folks would think of it as an interfaith marriage. So I think there's a difference in cultural orientation. The CRC did not have as many bridging ties to broader culture because so much of their social and religious life was tied up within the Christian school and the church. Secondly is a political difference, a church polity difference. Both denominations claim to be Presbyterian in church order, that is, that they follow that way of doing church government. I make the claim that CRC is a case study of what sociologist of religion Steve Warner calls de facto congregationalism. So they might claim a Presbyterian church order, but what they actually practice is congregationalism. And what we mean by congregationalism is that all authority rests at the local level. Whereas for the RCA, they actually are a more pure Presbyterian church polity. In the RCA, the classis or the regional body of churches actually had significant control over what an individual congregation did with their church building. If they wanted to make a move, they had to file some paperwork and make a claim about why the move was necessary and why they would need to build a new church building in a different location. In the CRC, on the other hand, the congregation has complete autonomy in regard to their church building. So they could literally, if they had wanted to, move out of Chicago, move into a suburb, and literally build a new church right next to a pre-existing CRC congregation. There's nothing the denomination could do about it. There's nothing the classes could do about it. So that's a difference there. And we see this play out in Chicago because the RCA churches, when they wanted to move out of the city, the onus is put on them, defend the move. How can you make a claim that you've had a ministry in this neighborhood for over 100 years, but all of a sudden now it's time to move someplace else? It made the churches or congregations that wanted to move think pretty hard about how they could defend the move to the suburbs.
So far, we've talked a lot about church organization structures and social practices, but I'm wondering about theology. What role, if any, did placemaking or commitment to urban spaces have in the theology of these churches?
With the influence of Abraham Kuyper on the CRC, he would have assumed that there was a strong sense that we should engage culture and where we're at. His famous quote is, there's not one square inch of creation over which Christ does not cry, mine. So with that kind of ethos, you would assume that the CRC would have a strong emphasis on, we want to make this place a rich and diverse place. Maybe we can have a multiracial church, but there's very little commitment at that time at the congregational level. What you see from both denominations, though, is that the higher synodical levels, so the upper reaches of the church governing bodies, incredibly progressive, I think anyway, for the time. What I think is interesting, though, is the CRC, the younger church, actually adapts to what I would call more American congregational practices of church government, because the church that they had descended out of in the Netherlands actually was a more parish-based type of church. That is, it was more Catholic, where you worshiped where you lived, right? You didn't necessarily go church shopping and find the church that most suited your worship tastes. You went to the church that you could walk to. It's kind of fits with the whole idea of election and predestination. You know, you didn't choose God, and so you don't get to choose where you go to church, is the way I've heard it explained to me by some Dutch theologians that still practice that in the Netherlands. But at the ground level, we don't see a whole lot of evidence of the idea of placemaking or a lot of commitment to urban places.
To what extent are the Christian Reformed congregations you write about reflective of how other evangelicals in the U.S. or other Protestants have related to their urban environments?
I think the reason why this case study of Christian Reformed churches actually matters is because of the way they reflect the dominant patterns of evangelical congregational life in the United States. And what I mean by that is, within evangelicalism, there tends to be a diffuse authority structure. So each congregation does what's best for them. It goes back to Steve Warner's idea of de facto congregationalism. And so with that in mind, if we think of congregations as organisms, Of course they're bent on survival. And they're going to find the richest habitat that most meets their needs. And so in that way of thinking, it shouldn't surprise us when the church as an organism follows a richer habitat out to the suburbs or, you know, to whatever place they might find more resources or more attenders. And so I think this model of self-survival is fairly dominant and with little regard for what it might mean for the places that they move to and move from, and with little regard for authority structures.
How have evangelicals typically understood racism? Have they tried to confront it, and how so?
Evangelicals have attempted to confront racism, but they've tended to only understand it as an individual level failure or sin. I reference Michael Emerson and Christian Smith's book, Divided by Faith, throughout my own book, because I think what they write about evangelicals and racism and racialization in the United States is so profound. Because the evangelicals rely on an individualistic cultural toolkit, to use their words, makes them less able to understand structural racism and institutional discrimination. What that translates into is individualistic solutions to racism. So rather than addressing structures and institutions, if I make friends with someone who's a different race than I am, that's the way that we address racism. So Emerson and Smith make the claim that that's very problematic because it doesn't take into account, you know, the racism that's built into lending practices and into healthcare and into education. And beyond that, but then they also rely on something that Emerson and Smith refer to as the miracle motif, that basically we can get rid of racism in the United States if we would just have more and more people convert to Christianity. And again, that would do nothing to address any kinds of structural inequities based on race.
What would you say is the relevance of your analysis today, given that affluent persons, particularly empty nesters and young millennials, are now moving back into the city? Is white flight simply a thing of the past?
As we think about perhaps this great inversion, to use Alan Ehrenwald's word, this idea that the elites are moving back into cities, we're not quite sure yet about whether this is a larger trend or if it's a blip related to the recession that began in 2008. So I'm less than sanguine about how big this movement is. I think the 50-year trajectory of moving out to the suburbs is still quite strong, take a lot to overcome. And it'll be interesting to see when the young millennials, when they start having kids, will they stay in the city? One of my chief concerns in the book is the fact that decisions by religious institutions were made with little regard for the places that they were being left behind and the places that they were relocating to. So I'm making an argument that these institutions should provide stronger leadership in thinking about these things. Too often, I saw religious institutions that simply followed wherever it was that their attenders went or the school children went and really provided meager leadership when it came to issues of social justice and racial reconciliation. And so as we continue to see cities churn and demographics change, every 10 years the census shows us something about racial demographic shifting. How do churches respond to that? And how do they do that in a careful way that doesn't displace people, doesn't abandon people, and ultimately considers place and is attentive to the places in the city, but also have a measure of humility in relating to their communities. A lot of times, churches think that they have a lot to offer and can become a bit condescending to the places, especially if there's a racial difference between the people who worship at the church and those who live around the church.
One last question, Mark. What do you want your readers to take away from this book?
My chief concern was to convey the sense that religion matters and that we need to pay careful attention to the complexities of urban social life. That's why I had a problem with the term white flight and sweeping generalizations about urban life. If you look at studies from the past couple of years, you see that poverty in certain urban neighborhoods is becoming more concentrated. It's deepening. The percentage of people who live in poverty in certain places is growing. So gentrification gets a lot of attention, but I still think a more critical issue is hypersegregation and the attendant poverty that exists along with that segregation. And I want to better understand how we got to this situation, and I think that religious life and religious cultural patterns played a role. And I think we need to be attentive to that because we continue to be a nation of largely churchgoers. We have over 300,000 congregations. There's a lot of discussion right now about disaffiliation with churches. But Robert Putnam, in his book American Grace, actually makes the claim that these folks who are disaffiliated right now, many, many, many of them are interested in spiritual things, and as they could find a church they could find attractive, that they would probably go there as well. What I'm really deeply interested in is the intersection of religion and how it shaped the cities that we inhabit today.
Well, on that note, we will conclude this episode. Again, the book is Shades of White Flight, Evangelical Congregations and Urban Departure. Thanks to Mark Mulder for joining us, and thanks to all of our listeners for tuning in. Have a great day.